Every day we come more to realize the importance of a balanced approach toward living. At this time, nearly everyone is off on some kind of a tangent. And as a result of having lost central stability, these good people are more or less constantly agitated, worried, frightened, disillusioned, and gradually lose health as well as happiness. The answer seems to be a diversification of activities. We are now being educated to specialize. In the next 20 years, we probably will produce 10 or 15 million commuter operators. We'll have computers everywhere. We will have the individual training for this from infancy. And by the time it is proper for him to go out and establish a home or raise children, he will be at a hopeless disadvantage. He will not know anything about the normal processes of living. This same problem is present in most of our educational institutions. They are all built to produce specialists. They are produced to increase the depth of knowledge in some given field. And it now takes many, many years to complete a basic education in a highly specialized field. The individual who is looking for a doctorate will be lucky if he graduates in his 30s. In the older days, things were quite different, and in some ways more reasonable. Back in the days of Greek learning, education was largely in the keeping of a few professional teachers who fulfilled all the chairs of their students' needs. These teachers were persons widely acquainted with the processes of living. They were teaching the individual how to become useful without becoming hopelessly indoctrinated in something. Philosophy was largely the instrument of ancient learning, and philosophy was nearly always grounded in personal experience and demonstrated or proven by its solutional powers. The individual grew up to be a thinker. He did not simply accept the thoughts of others. He did not consider himself educated simply because he had read the approved authors. He was taught from the beginning the emergencies of immediate living. In those older days, institutions were not as complicated as they are now, but problems have been with us since the beginning. And the ancient systems of learning were largely directed at solving problems and producing persons capable of individual existence. This does not mean that these individuals turned against each other or were competitive, but it simply meant that the person, through the development of his faculties, was able to come to useful conclusions about his own needs. Having been presented with a problem, he used the native faculties with which he had been endowed to solve that problem. He was taught to believe in the solutional power of his own judgment. And, in most instances, this solutional power worked until the development of highly specialized scientific techniques. As the fields of knowledge broadened, they became, in a sense, deeper, and in another sense, more shallow. In the case of developing industrial structures, the individual was bound to make a living. He had to follow the approved rules of his time. He had to train himself for a job. This in itself, of course, was a limiting influence. And the more precarious his economic situation, the more intensely he specialized his abilities, striving always for an excellence in some field. Now in the 20th century, we have an almost incredible diversity of activities. These activities are not any longer simply jobs. They're careers. They're lifetime dedications. They are devotions based upon the need for financial security. These infinitely diversified activities, however, do not seem to diversify the capacity of the individual to meet problems. He must try to solve his problems in terms of the learning he has received, and a large part of modern learning has nothing to do with solving problems except economic stability. The learning makes the individual fit to earn a living, but does not equip him to learn to live a life. He is deficient in the natural, homely aspects of intelligence, which our forefathers seem to possess in reasonable abundance. So today we have people who sort of live on little islands. These little islands are of many kinds and types. Among the more interesting of these islands, perhaps, is the religious island. Here, individuals belonging to certain beliefs isolate themselves from the beliefs of all other people and settle down to defend their own convictions. To depart from these convictions is heresy, and the person who is brought up in a narrowed religious community is subject to persecution even today for nonconformity. Therefore, in religion, we have a group of people to whom religious matters are supremely important. Now, no one doubts this importance, but we can doubt the attitude of the individuals involved in most instances. The importance of the subject is not primarily sectarian. Religion is not important because it teaches a dogma. Religion is important because it inspires a way of life by which the individual is capable of facing the emergencies of living. If we take, therefore, religion on the level of utility, basic usefulness to man, sectarianism has a tendency to retreat because we find that nearly all religions are useful to the needs of people. And persons of many different beliefs depend heavily upon their spiritual convictions for the courage for daily living. Therefore, the purpose of religion primarily is to give us a new sense of value by which we can live more constructively and have greater incentives to integrity. Now, in the actual course of religious growth, we also find another important peculiarity which we need to consider. One of these special points is that the individual has gradually allowed religious attitudes to dominate secular living without moral conviction. For example, the point we want to make is that the person constantly thinking about religion, reading about it, allowing it to completely dominate his life, often neglects the very use for which religion was intended. He becomes absorbed in doctrines. He becomes so completely immersed in certain religious attitudes that he loses track of other values in life that are very important also. Christ said to render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and unto God the things that are his. Many religious people today simply deny Caesar. They render nothing to him. They make no serious effort to adjust to problems of daily living. Others must come to them. They will not go out and join in any general, practical, spiritual procedures. If this happens, then religion, instead of being an ever-present help, becomes a menace to the integrity of the person. If he would have the virtues of faith without becoming obsessed by the techniques of theology, he would be much happier, wiser, better, and more useful to society. But if he allows religion to paralyze his natural integrities and to force him into a position in which he can naturally mingle only with his own believers, who will not modify his position to meet the emergencies of the day, but continues in a dogged adherence to something which he probably does not even understand. If he takes this attitude, he is in trouble. Now, on the other end of the scale, we take the scientific thinker. Here is a person who has a commitment that is just as devout, just as emotional, and perhaps even more intense than many religious devotions. To the scientific mind, the exploration of the unknown has become practically an obsession. He must advance knowledge at all cost. But the problem he constantly faces is that the knowledge he most needs eludes him. He can find a great deal of interesting information, but the type of knowledge which would enable him to live well in his own family is not always available. He becomes addicted to a great project. He becomes a crusader, trying to expand the knowledge which we possess and broaden the horizons of our understanding. But actually, he is working largely with an abstract situation, and he will go down to his grave with all others without having solved the reason for his own existence. He is not able to allow his natural devotional instincts to have a proper play. He becomes, in a sense, possessed by the tremendous adventure of learning, and therefore does not pause long enough to make learning a value in his daily existence. Again, the only real value he gains is perhaps a more substantial income from his scientific attainments. As a person, he does not grow very much because he is locked in an attitude. Now, most people do not become quite that much locked. And the common citizen, the average person that we all meet, know, and mingle with, is not as intense as this in his allegiances. But he also can be a desert island in the community where he lives. He can be without the necessary instruments of understanding to be a useful, cooperative, constructive citizen. These things he has to take into very serious consideration. Now, we may say, for instance, that a person comes home from work and is tired and has earned a living, paid his bills, or found out where to borrow enough money to pay them temporarily. And what does he do? He probably settles down in front of the television to forget it all. He wants relaxation. He wants release from pressure. He wants to get away from the utilities into something which he hopes will prove an interesting avocational outlet. If he is at all intelligent, he will realize that he is sadly mistaken, that he is not getting any outlet, that he actually is building more and more nervous tension into his system, that he is learning nothing that is important to him, and he is suffering greater tension shocks than he would in the ordinary procedures of his daily business life. One other point is very important. Most entertainment is imaginary. Most entertainment is a form of propaganda. It is dedicated largely to creating an audience which is best held by shock and stress. Many persons listening or watching, come to the conclusion that they live in a world of corruption. Practically every decent value fades from their minds because of the hypnotic influence of fiction. The stories that they're seeing, even if partly historical, have been completely enveloped in a kind of salesmanship. These events have been dramatized, exaggerated, or even misplaced or misplayed in order simply to hold audience attention. So the person getting through with this type of entertainment probably loses what little confidence he might otherwise have in the society to which he belongs. He becomes more and more impressed with the realization that he lives in a corrupt society and therefore his own ideals have little hope fulfillment. Actually, he's in the same position when he starts to read. If he reads the popular books of the day, he is further disillusioned. If he listens to commentaries on news, he loses faith in everything, including himself. Gradually, he falls into a kind of miasma. He is in a quicksand of popular abuse of media. And in this condition, he is more and more depressed, more and more certain that the world in which he lives has no appreciation of value, and he might as well join the others and commit whatever crimes are essential to material success. All of this shows lack of personal integration. The individual is not controlling his own life. He is a mass of defense and escape mechanisms. He is not using the faculties with which he has been endowed. He is not ruling his own life. He lacks the strength and stamina to lead his own conduct in the directions it should go. Now, one thing that will help this a great deal is for the person to enlarge or broaden his fields of association with society. It is useless for him to make the fundamental mistake of looking for people who agree with him. He would like to have all his friends think the same way that he does. If this happens, he will then be making the same mistakes that they make, and they will be perpetuating his mistakes. He will look at the friends who agree with him, and he may find they have broken homes, broken health, losing their jobs, and in debt most of their lives. But they agree with him on some point, therefore they are his friends. What he should be looking for is persons who are living well with different points of view. We are so involved in the idea that we are always right and that other people must agree with us that we do not look at the people who we think do agree with us. If we did, we would find they are not any better off than we are. In fact, they indicate very often the difficulties that are going to soon come to us because of our attitudes. So it's very necessary to get accustomed to looking at other people with other points of view. If you are a businessman and are hard at work in some capacity of making a living, perhaps you should take up music. Or perhaps you should go to a craft school and study pottery making. Or perhaps go in and study some type of creative artistry or craft. Simply to meet people who have different points of view. It may be that to you, a certain position in your corporation is your goal. But you should meet people who have other goals, who do not work in this direction at all. Some people are perfectly happy if they can produce a good dinner. Others will not be for a moment happy unless they are vice presidents of a corporation. Get into knowing people whose attitudes have their own fulfillments that are different from ours. The more different attitudes we are able to understand, the broader our own foundations will become. We will have more contact with real life. and we will gradually recognize the importance of diversifying activity. Diversification does not mean wasting time. It does not mean simply recreating. It means the spreading of our mental capacities over a larger area of expression, so that we can think better on more subjects, that we can understand why other people have their dedications, and we will begin to respect other people instead of regarding everyone who differs from us as more or less moronic. We cannot afford just simply to stand out and criticize what other people believe. What we must try to do is find out why they believe what they do and try to share in some of the beliefs that are important to them. We cannot really grow until we develop the power to tolerate differences of opinion. We must enjoy the right to our own convictions, but these convictions should be tested and tried by comparison with other convictions to see whether really we have the best approach to the subject under consideration. So we like to think of the importance of the average person becoming widely acquainted with many fields of activity, which will bring with them many friendships, contacts, outlets, which are progressive, constructive, and useful. Instead of sitting in front of some television constantly, it would be far better to become more involved in social activities in the community. It would be more important to work with various groups that are planning improvements in living, in thought, various ways of finding new creative expressions, particularly in the areas of the retired citizen. The retired person must begin to depend more and more upon his own innate accomplishments. He cannot depend so heavily upon his outside social contacts. But he should have abilities that are within himself. No human being in this world shall die of boredom. If he is approaching that condition, it is because of a serious failure in himself. Up to the very last moments of useful living, there are things to learn, things to know, things to do. And these broaden and stretch the uses of the mind. We have a great deal of brain fag these days. A mind that is forced to think on the same subject all the time, or is confronted with similar problems continuously, and is unable to cope with them, this mind gradually becomes exhausted. It may lead into some very unfortunate or dangerous habit, as alcoholism. It may cause the person to give up in despair, when with just a little common sense and he would be on his feet and doing well. This problem makes it very valuable, very necessary for us to use the mind with a full understanding of what a mind is. So let's think for a moment, what is a mind? A mind in action, and not in principle, but in action, is an instrument for the gaining of information and the application of this information to the problems of daily living. In other words, the mind is a machine that takes the various testimonies of the sensory perceptions, subjects them to reflection, and upon reflection builds an attitude toward life. This is a very important procedure, and we are all involved in it every single day. Every moment of life, something is coming into the mind, some new experience, some new point of view, a new problem read in the newspaper, a little problem heard from the neighbor over the fence. These things are coming in constantly. Also, through our natural contact with life, we watch people. We see them. We know what is happening to them. We look at the large pattern of the community in which we live, and we see how people live and think, the problems they face, and the various escapes which they try to use to get out of their responsibilities. The mind, therefore, is an organizing, ordering power within us. It used to be represented by an old gentleman who was called a philosopher. And the mind is capable of being the teacher, the ancient teacher within ourselves. Ancient because it has been here since the dawn of time. The mind, therefore, can give us the information we want if we ask for it. Even a computer will not give us information unless we feed in the necessary data. The mind cannot give us the proper answer unless we feed into the mind the various types of evidence which we wish it to consider and organize. The mind is capable of a tremendous diversity of activities. The average human mind is capable of being organized into more than 40 distinct careers. Now, only one or two of those will ever be used. But the mind can make us see or do almost anything that we really become interested in. They say that Leonardo da Vinci mastered 60 arts and sciences. That might be a slight exaggeration, I don't know. But anyway, he did very well. He proved conclusively that the mind can think more thoughts than the average person ever demands from it. That instead of the mind simply being something to fulfill the notion of the moment, it can provide us with proofs and disproofs on almost any subject. It can give us the stamina to attack a difficult field of research. It can give us the patience to face a definitely difficult domestic situation. In every field of life, the mind is not only able to face situations, create some types of solutions, and also it is able to contemplate the consequences of its own decisions. The mind can show us because it can understand and accept the fact that it may have made a mistake itself. That the mind has maybe has led us into something that was going to be disastrous. But it is also capable of realizing this and immediately setting to work to correct the mistake. The mind, having this tremendous potential, was evidently given to us because we were not supposed to be one-track people. We were not supposed to live completely on one field of endeavor. Out into the larger society to which we belong, we see that mind and nature and the divine plan have divided us into countless nations, races, beliefs, philosophies, arts, crafts, sciences, and industries. It has diversified our world and has produced within our own human existence specialists in all these fields. Now, these people were not born specialists. Some had special aptitudes, that is true. But most of them finally developed their specialties as a result of specialized education. Now, specialized education today is, it seems to me, a rather faulty institution. I do not believe that the average institution of education is doing the things that are best for the mind of the students. They are bound totally to the economic potentials. They want to produce graduates who can get a job. They want to help to satisfy the ambitions of young people who would like to start at the top and believe that education will give them a better chance to advance towards a higher estate. The schools, therefore, sacrifice cheerfully the possibility of the individual becoming a well-matured thinker. Instead of producing thinkers, they are gradually producing mechanized intellects that are tied to certain definite patterns from which they find difficulty in escaping. This situation cannot always be rectified. It probably will not be entirely solved until the individual who has been prepared for one of these careers gets out into life and tries to live according to what he has learned. He then may discover that he can't live with the learning that he has. That the learning that he has may keep him employed, would destroy everything else in his life. And this is not a valuable pattern upon which to build careers. The purpose of a good education is to make the individual sensitive to all forms of improved knowledge. It should make him appreciate all kinds of things that he very often does not give a thought to today. I know a lot of people, for instance, who consider themselves well-educated. You suggest that they'd like to go down and visit an art gallery. They look at you as though they thought you were mad. Why should they look at an art gallery when they can stay home and watch a football game? The meaning of art is simply missing. A foundation for art appreciation should have been a part of education. It might not be the major part if the person is looking for a career, but it should have been encouraged. And at the present time, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology is functioning with humanity courses. It is setting in appreciation courses for fields entirely apart from science. Because the scientist who has nothing else will end up by being a bad scientist. He is becoming too narrow. He is becoming too unscientific in his way of advancing his own scientific knowledge. So we find people with no appreciation of anything and proud of it. They are glad to have everybody know that they have only one interest in life. They feel that this is a sign that they are serious, dedicated individuals with every intention of getting ahead. Usually, instead of accomplishing their end, they develop serious ailments involving especially mental, nervous, and cardiac ailments. The human being was meant to be a universal creature. The human being was intended to be able to express all forms of skills and knowledge. And just as there are 50 or more major professions in which man functions at the present time, so all of these professions are within himself. The potential to appreciate, to understand, to sympathize, to realize, all these things are parts of knowledge. But we are neglecting these parts in the desperate effort to become opulent in a materialistic civilization. Now we have the problem then of the money. The individual with the education that he now has goes on, he becomes expert in his field, he may become an Einstein, or he may become a great financier. But I think it's rather interesting to remember that Einstein also played the violin, which was quite a little ways from his scientific interest. But it was an indication that he did have some type of artistic expression, something to break up the tremendous intensity of mathematics, which might otherwise have prevented him from ever being a constructive member of society. He had to have this type of progress. Andrew Carnegie once said that every man should live rich and die poor. He should dispose of everything that he has as he gets older, seeing that all of his possessions become part of a community asset. And for this reason, he created libraries. He also created the Carnegie Institute and many other charitable, philanthropic, and educational institutions. It was his sincere opinion that every man should die penniless. Otherwise, his life is a failure. And of course, the most terrible mistake he can make is to die rich and leave it to his children. But everywhere in life, there are things to be done. You will find also that many autocorrectives creep in. In occasion, we find cases where powerful financiers have also become great patrons of culture. Example here in our own community was Huntington, a businessman up to the neck, but also a person with a basic appreciation of values or beauty, who was determined to leave something behind that would be of value to the society to which he belonged. Now, we can't all do these things, but we can all so live that we make diversified contributions to the well-being of each other. We can not only help individuals to be practical, we can help them to be kind. We not only can help the individual to be devout and to have a good religion, but we can teach him to respect the religion of other people and find joy in the spirit of religion rather than in its letter. One of the things we have learned lately is the problem of the missionary field. The missionary field has two great programs at the present time, one of which is valid and the other is doubtful. The valid program is that the power of the missionary field to assist the survival of underprivileged people and to take care of the physical needs, as far as possible, of the victims of political tyranny. But if the missionary field limits itself to the point that those it helps must accept its theology, then we may be in worse condition than we realize. Because most of the people to whom the missionaries go have had, or do have, a basic religion which is morally and ethically similar to their own. The problem is to help these people to have the chance to live their faiths, because by so doing, it becomes unnecessary for us to completely rebuild a religion from the ground up. We can simply take the faith the man has or the woman has and build upon it a proof that that faith is justified, and that in somewhere in the universe, the principle of love which dominates all religion is active in different creeds, different institutions, and on different theological levels. It is very important to get this broadness into things. Now, on the other hand, broadness, without some form of mentation to support it, very often can become very sloppy. I know one man who has been trying for years to be broad-minded enough to accept certain, post-impressionistic art. He has never really been able to love some of the peculiar drawings and so forth which cause certain experts to go into ecstasy. It looks pretty terrible to him. Now he is faced in a problem. Is he right? Is it an atrocity? Or is he simply unable to understand something that is strangely and fantastically beautiful, but does not look that way to him? The answer in all probability is that if it doesn't appear right for him, it isn't his. It isn't the thing that he can do. There's no reason why he should force himself to enjoy something that is not enjoyable simply because it is popular, or because it has a few highly technical critics supporting it. Therefore, the person must have within himself enough mental courage, mental determination, to decide for himself what is good and what is not good. And he should not permit popular opinion to destroy his own sense of values. He must try constantly to live in accordance with the creative and constructive instincts in his own nature. But how will he judge beauty? How will he know whether art is good or not? How will he know whether music has a future? How can he tell the difference between that which is a passing fad and that which is part of basic progress for humanity? Again, it's only his own inner life that can tell him. And the only way that that inner life can tell him is that while he has been a businessman or a merchant, or while he has been an electronic engineer or a computer operator, he has also given attention to the arts, that he is aware of what is good art and what he enjoys. He will not therefore be forced to build a solution without any knowledge within himself. Everywhere, I think, the essay of Plotinus on the beautiful is useful. Beautiful is that which ennobles. If the individual seeing it is not a better person for having seen it, it isn't beauty. The dictionary says that beauty is an idealistic, constructive thing, that it represents harmony, that it represents integrities. By even by the dictionary definition, it should be possible to determine what things are beautiful and what are not. But that which is repulsive to the inner life of the person is not for him. Now, his neighbor may say that what he does not like, his neighbor will like. And his neighbor will go on to expound on the marvels and wonders of this thing which we do not appreciate. We listen. We think about it. We try to see if there's some value in it that we've overlooked. Then we consider the person whose opinion we have just heard. On what does he base his opinion? Is it because of beauty within himself, or is it because he's read a very good review on the subject and feels that the reviewer must be right and that he must change his old attitudes to meet the popular opinion? If it's this last, he's wrong. We have the right to judge all of these factors, but to judge them, we have to have acquaintance with them. We have to use some of the side time that we are now largely wasting trying to find out the values we need for daily living. We're not going to get them by the processes now popularly used. We're just going to get worse and worse and worse. In order, therefore, to really make something out of the problem, we have to realize that integrities are moral, emotional, mental, physical, that the individual who is living by a poor code is also endangering his health and depriving his mind of the proper incentives for growth. We must try then to find out how to really educate the mind. Well, according to Lord Bacon, there are three instruments of knowledge. One is tradition, one is experience, and one is experimentation. Now, a lot of people today are denying the validity of tradition. They say that if it's old, it's no good. This is entirely wrong, and much is to say that a person over 60 is worthless. Tradition is valuable. Tradition is the only way in which we can take advantage of the world's knowledge and not be forced to live from the beginning of it with each generation.